This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the vote for independence in Catalonia. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Catalonia, a semi-autonomous region in Spain, voted to secede from Spain in an October 1st referendum. But the turnout was only 48%, since those opposed to the poll mostly stayed away. Riot police attempting to disrupt voting injured hundreds of people, causing outrage and further protests. The central government in Madrid says the vote was illegal because it violates Spain's constitution, which upholds the indissoluble unity of Spain. Catalonia, a part of the Spanish state for centuries, has its own distinct language and culture and enjoys broad autonomy under the Spanish constitution. However, a 2005 amendment redefining the region as a, quote, nation, boosting the status of the Catalan language and increasing local control over taxes and the judiciary, was reversed by the Constitutional Court in 2010. A subsequent economic crisis fueled discontent, and pro-independence parties took power in the region in the 2015 elections. Meantime, in a recent address to Catalonia's regional parliament, President Carles Puigdemont appeared to pull back from the brink by declaring independence from Spain. He said even though the region has earned the right to independence, he suspended the process to allow for talks with the central government in Madrid. The European Union has made it clear that if Catalonia split from Spain, the region would cease to be part of the EU. Some analysts say this is the worst crisis to buffet Spain since a failed coup in 1981. Joining us to discuss the Catalonian referendum and its implications are Carles Castelló Cacho. He is the chief of staff of the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, and that's a prominent think tank here in Washington, and Garrett Martin. He's professor in the School of International Service at American University, also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both. Carles Castelló, let me begin with you. I know you are of Catalonian descent. Mm-hmm. It'd be very interesting to get your take from a personal perspective. But I want to ask you to step back. How did we get to this point? What are the main factors, in your view, that triggered this referendum for independence?
Well, I thought your introduction covered the basis pretty well. This is a combination of discontent from the population who had been hit hard by the economic crisis. Part of the narrative of the Catalan government is that more independence, they'll be able to better manage their resources, their taxes, and so more investment is going to come to the region. And there's, of course, a huge historical factor. I mean, the Catalans, since 1714, when the Spanish forces entered the region and declared that Spain would be like one unified nation, have been kind of fighting the cause. They say they have their own language, their own history, and they want to see their destiny fulfilled in an independent nation. And so it's economic causes, it's historical causes, and of course, we have currently a government in central Spain that has not been very attentive to any of this.
Turning to you, Garrett Martin, for your take on how we got here, what are the main factors in your view that triggered the referendum? Picking up on what Carles Castelló just said, how much responsibility does the Spanish government bear?
I would definitely echo a lot of what Carles has said about the causes. There are certainly a mix. There's the collective memory of the Franco period, which is often invoked as a sign of Catalan identity, Catalan language being repressed. And there are enough people in Catalonia who remember that time period. So I think that creates a certain narrative. The narrative about Spain robs us, because there is a principle of solidarity between the regions, which is ingrained in the Spanish government. So the better-to-do regions in Spain provide subsidies or they send money back to other regions. So I think in times of economic crisis, that sentiment, I think, has been exacerbated, the resentment of having to send more money back to Madrid than is being sent back to Catalonia. So I think that has played certainly a big role. And I think there's also the international dimension. I mean, you have in 2014 the example of Scotland. So a very different situation. I'm sure we can cover it later. But that, I think, provided, emboldened the independence forces in Catalonia. I mean, there was a non-binding vote in November 2014, about 2 months after the Scottish vote. So I think that certainly has played a big role in getting us to this point. In terms of, if I remember your question about could the Spanish government have acted differently, certainly I think in terms of the optics of sending that many police forces, the heavy-handed nature, I think that provided a real moral victory for the independence, or the supporters of independence in Catalonia. I think it's only hardened the views of those who were on the fence and who may be considering independence. So I think it certainly has backfired, and probably in the long run it will come back to haunt the Rajoy government.
Turning back to you, Carles, to what extent do you think the reversal of this 2005 amendment, which redefined the region as a, quote, nation, boosting its status with the Catalan language and increasing local control over taxes and the judiciary, the reversal of that by the Constitutional Court in 2010, what role did that play in your view?
Well, I think it was is one of the key factors that led us to this moment, right? It's like for the first time there was a vote, it was a legal vote in Catalonia to say we won a new constitution, a new framework of relationship with Spain. The stars were aligned. We had a socialist government in the central Spanish government. We had like a three-party government in Catalonia, also with the socialists and the Republicans. And so there was some sort of agreement that now is the right moment to actually have these discussions, because both parties are aligned, the population is ready for it. And we all agree in Spain that the constitution that was written in 1978 is kind of outdated and needs some sort of reframing. And so 2005 was seen as the perfect moment to take that extra step. The problem is, of course, the Constitutional Court is there to make sure that the constitution is protected. And the constitution says that sovereignty is one and unified under Spain, and that this mention of other nations being part of the same state is not correct. And so the Constitutional Court started like chopping off that document, which was then sent to the Spanish parliament, which further chopped it off. And so the problem from a Catalan perspective is like, we all voted this, we all agreed on this new document, there was a consensus between both governments, and then the courts basically like tore it down. And that creates a lot of resentment, because it was seen as the one opportunity for real dialogue. Again, a lot of friends, a lot of people back home will say, we already tried negotiating, we were not listened to. And so we're going our own way. We're going the independence route, and we're not going to go back to the negotiating table because it proved worthless. It just feeds the narrative of Madrid is never going to listen. Our only way out is independence.
What about that idea or that perception that Madrid is never going to listen, Gerrit Martin? Because, again, my question is, could this day have been avoided? In other words, did Madrid miss opportunities to dialogue, notwithstanding this reversal of that 2005 amendment by the Constitutional Court in 2010? Were there opportunities between, you know, 2010 and today that Madrid could have taken advantage of, whether perhaps championing a so-called Scotland-like referendum? What prevented Madrid from doing that, from having a dialogue?
Well, let me address first the question about why did Spain not follow the model of the United Kingdom? Well, there's one fundamental difference, and I think which is key here. The UK, famously, is one of few countries in the world that does not have a written constitution. It has precedents, it has statutes that have evolved over time, but the lack of a written constitution inevitably provides a degree of flexibility. So that was one major difference. Secondly, the Scottish Nationalist Party had quite a clear majority from the 2011 elections. They had a clearer mandate. In the 2015 regional elections in Catalonia, the verdict was a bit more ambiguous because, yes, there was a majority for parties in favor in terms of seats, but not a majority in terms of votes. And, you know, in the Scottish process, it was also progressive negotiations. It was a well-planned independence referendum. There was an agreement in the fall of 2012, differences between the Scottish case and the Catalonia case. Now, I think there's also a question of politics. I mean, we're talking about Madrid, but I think there's also the fact that there are differences within the Spanish political spectrum. It was Mariano Rajoy's party in 2006 which challenged the revision of the statutes in 2006. And so there's resentment in that sense. I think Rajoy's party certainly believes that the devolution of power to the region has already been sufficient. And so there's not a lot of willingness to go further. Other parties on the political spectrum, like Podemos, might be more open to certain changes. But even the Socialist Party, I think, currently would not really be in favor of a referendum either. So there's also that element of you have to look at the dynamics of Spanish politics as well.
How do you see the dynamic of Spanish politics, Carles Castelló? And also, to be the devil's advocate, we know that Catalonia, and particularly Barcelona, the region has one of the highest standards of living in Europe, along with considerable political and cultural autonomy
as it is.
Correct.
So what more do they want?
Correct. It's a very tricky issue. On political dynamics, we need to remember, one, the current government in Spain is the center-right government, very nationalistic on the Spanish side of things. And they are basically feeding off each other. We have two nationalisms butting heads and feeding each other's rhetoric, which works really well electorally, both for Partido Popular, for the sitting prime minister, and for Puigdemont. And so the news from today is that, you know, the Socialist Party has agreed with the Popular Party, which is the one in government, to try to initiate a constitutional reform of sorts. And so finally, it looks like Mariano Rajoy understood that the 1978 constitution may not be the most up-to-date one and that there needs to be some sort of agreement on how to update it. That's very different from agreeing to Catalan independence, but at least let's see if we can get to a point in which the constitution has some sort of mechanism to allow each autonomy to decide for its own good where they want to go. And so that's part of the politics, and that's why I was referring to 2005 as the perfect moment in which we have moderate parties on both governments having a real dialogue about where they wanted to go. Right now we have two polar opposites in each government, basically trying to see, you know, who's going to give up first. Rajoy is not going to give up, and the Catalan government so far is not going to give up either. We also need to remember the ruling coalition in Catalonia. The big majority of that coalition was never pro-independence. They were pro-more autonomy and pro-nationalism, but, like, there's 10 extra seats, which is the extreme left, that has been pushing the agenda real hard. So Puigdemont, in a way, is also captive of those 10 seats.
Does he belong to that faction?
He does not. And that explains in part what happened last week in Parliament, which was a declaration of independence with a reversal 6 seconds afterwards, which was, we're going to freeze these because I think the ideal scenario for Puigdemont is we need to negotiate with Madrid. Hopefully they're going to give us more autonomy, better resources, and we're not going to have to go that far. And here's the trick. The independent coalition is split up inside too.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Carles Castelló Cacho. He's chief of staff of the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. That's a think tank here in Washington. And Garrett Martin. He's professor in the School of International Service at American University here in Washington. We're discussing the recent vote for independence in Catalonia, Spain, and its implications for Spain and Europe. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Sylvia Billy from Jos, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're back to our special guest talking about the Catalonia referendum. Back to you, Garrett Martin, about the vote itself. Now, it's not seen as valid, of course, by Spain and by Europe and many others. So many in the no camp stayed away, not even 50% voted. How do you see this vote? Can you break it down demographically? Who voted yes and why? Who didn't vote and why?
Well, it's very hard to speak categorically about the vote because of the conditions under which it operated. It was not properly monitored. It was not necessarily based on proper census. Some of the rules were changed at the last minute. So we have to treat the numbers at least with some skepticism or at least some caution. Now, it's quite possible that those who did turn out to vote were those who were motivated by independence, and the results might be relatively accurate, but it's hard to say.
Were they young, older? I'm just curious about the demographics as well.
Well, certainly we've noticed in some of the studies that there is a correlation between age and between whether Catalan is your first language or Spanish, Castilian, is your first language. Those who speak Catalan in priority tend to be stronger supporters of independence. Young people also tend to speak Catalan more, so therefore they are also tend to support independence more. But there's also a bit of an urban-rural divide. You mentioned earlier that Barcelona has great prestige, great culture, great autonomy, but there's a fewer number of Catalan speakers in Barcelona itself. There are more Catalan speakers in the more rural areas. So I think that probably speaks a little bit to the sort of divide and the demographic that we can see in the vote.
So turning to you, Carles Castelló, how do you see the vote breakdown? And do you think those who did vote yes, the sort of true believers, do they understand the implications of this, what they were doing? Because many would say the costs of such a vote and the concrete implications, leaving the European Union, being isolated, the costs, you know, would outweigh the benefits at the end of the day.
Yeah, so on the vote itself, it was very interesting. We're not even reaching 50% of the population. And so the other thing is, as Gary was saying, there was not even a census. The only census that we have is from 2015. And so how things changed in these last 2 years and who voted, how many times they voted, there was no way, there were no mechanisms to decide, like, how the voting was happening. So from a legal point of view, the referendum is a very tough one to sell to the international community and to anyone concerned about some legal framework. So on your second question on the cost-benefit analysis, that's one of my main points of criticism, I think, with the current Catalan government. There's been zero explaining on what Catalonia after independence looked like. Of course, the European Union said, you guys are going to be out right after the vote. You're out of NATO. You have to rejoin the United Nations. Basically, you're kicked out of every international body. And so what the Catalan government said was, vote for independence and trust us, we'll be okay because we're such a rich region that no one will want to see us go. The problem when you're out of the club is that Spain has veto power in all these institutions, especially in the European Union. And so it's kind of a Cyprus-Turkey situation by which once Cyprus is in, it's going to be very complicated to allow Turkey to be in. Once Catalonia is out, I cannot foresee a Spanish government saying, like, yeah, we're totally fine with them automatically rejoining the European Union. And we're seeing the same with all the companies that are now fleeing the region, right? It's like all these companies were like basically hoping that this day would never come. Right now, the Spanish government had to like issue a express law saying, if you guys want to change your fiscal and your social headquarters, you can do so in 24 hours. And we've seen the seven major banks and companies from Catalonia just leaving the region within the last few days. So it is concerning because the Catalan government's point was, trust us, we're so powerful. We're such a, like an engine that no one will ever dare not letting us rejoin or not leaving the region. And now we're seeing the real consequences. And I think that's what cost puts them on, okay, maybe we need a couple more weeks to talk.
The European Union is worried. It's already jittery, right, Garrett Martin, about the, you know, rise of populist and nationalist movements throughout the continent. This is just not a trend that they would want to endorse. That said, we cannot condone in any way, shape, or form the strong-arm tactics of the Spanish government during the vote. Don't you think that Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy miscalculated? I mean, why did they do that? Why did they engage in violence? And didn't they think that this could backfire and actually make the secessionists look better?
It is striking that there was no consideration of the optics, how that would play, how that would play internationally, and how that would play also in other parts of Spain. Now, certainly, I think the Rajoy government has been very clear that this is an internal Spanish issue. So they've tried to sort of sidestep any idea of international mediation. And you can also understand that there's been not much of a push from other European capitals. You can understand that there would be a fear of a contagion effect, that other regions, Corsica, might suddenly try to create trouble for France in the hope of getting international mediation. So we can certainly see that there's not been a lot of pressure for other actors to step in. And you can also understand from the point of view of European leaders, they're looking at Catalonia and going, great, one more intractable fire to address, as if we didn't have enough to deal with. And values have been under attack in other parts of Europe. There's been a lot of focus on what Poland and Hungary is doing. And again, there has been a somewhat of a pragmatic response. So what we're seeing here is not so surprising in line of other events. And I would also very much echo the frustrating lack of planning about what independence would mean. Because, of course, it's a very emotional issue, but there are a lot of devastating consequences. For many older Catalans who've had their pensions in Spain, what will happen to them? What will happen for all the EU citizens who live in Catalonia? We're seeing the terrible side effects of that with Brexit, and I think that was disheartening that there wasn't more forethought about what independence would mean.
Back to you, Carles Castello. To talk about the speech by the president of Catalonia's parliament, Carles Puigdemont, some found it rather confusing. He both urged Madrid to enter into dialogue, but then affirmed that Catalonia had earned the right to independence. So what are we to make of that? How do we interpret that?
Well, I think it will go down in history as one of the most confusing moments in Spain's political circus that we're living on these days. As you say, the speech itself was to affirm that Catalonia had the right to be independent, which a lot of his followers thought it was a full declaration of independence. Then he proceeded to say, I'm asking my parliament to freeze all moves towards secession, to open a new window for a dialogue. That may take weeks, so he's not even putting a deadline on it. But then at the end of the session, the 72 pro-secession congressmen proceeded to sign the declaration itself. And so that's what triggered Madrid's response, which was, okay, we need to know exactly if you guys have declared independence or not, so we know how to react to that. The problem, again, is that both governments don't accept each other's legitimacy. And, you know, Spain sees there's one sovereignty, and accepting any kind of negotiation or mediation would be accepting that Catalonia has a claim. And that's the issue at hand. Is the government of Spain is waiting to see, like, what does this declaration mean? And I think the Catalan government, who miscalculated the reaction and miscalculated the fact that no international organization or other country would actually come in to support, now is facing the crude truth of what do we do next? So it was a very confusing moment for all. And we've seen it develop during this week.
Well, speaking of the confusing moment, so then that leads us to ask, what are the implications? What's the next steps? The EU, of course, is urging restraint and urging Prime Minister Rajoy to look for a peaceful solution without force. How optimistic are you, and what are the obstacles going forward? Can Catalonia have more self-determination without actually seceding?
Let's see. There are a lot of questions in there. So I'm optimistic about the non-use of force or violence to solve this issue for sure. What we will see the government of Spain do in the next few days is activate the mechanisms it has left to intervene the autonomy. So,
are you talking about Article 155?
Yeah, I'm talking about Article 155.
And let's just explain that that's the article which would allow the central government to take control of the autonomous region.
Correct. And it's a very broadly written article. And so I think a lot of experts are thinking that it's going to be a very gradual application of the article. First, they can intervene the security forces, then the tax mechanisms, basically forcing the Catalan government to eventually either give up and dissolve the parliament and go for new elections, go back to what they call legality. So the Spanish president has given Puigdemont a week to respond, have you guys declared independence or not, and has given Puigdemont 14 days to go back to what he declares is a constitutional legality. If that doesn't happen, then the Spanish state is going to intervene. I don't think that's going to involve use of force. And I think the Catalan government will be way smarter to try to either dissolve the parliament and call for new elections. But again, it's very complicated to be optimistic because both players at hand are situated now in the extremes. We don't have a centrist, moderated voice with the real power to actually make a peaceful solution happen.
And Garrett Martin, you get the last word on all this, what the next steps might be, and how do you see this unfolding?
It's hard to be very optimistic because I do agree, at least in the short term, I think there is going to be some elements of de-escalation. Rajoy does have the option of triggering Article 155 because it's a progressive process. There are multiple steps. Even invoking it in the first place could cause some form of reaction. I think there might be some promise of trying to put forward some form of constitutional reform. But that's a complicated process. It requires a large majority in the parliament, and currently this is a minority government for Rajoy. So he would need the support of a broad part of the Spanish political spectrum. There are also 17 communities or regions, so you would have to placate all 17, not just Catalonia. Now, in the short term, they might be able to find some kind of solution, but the problem will be, are they negotiating in good faith? For Madrid, they might think, okay, this is the final concession. For Puigdemont and company, they might think we can temporarily compromise, but with the idea that we still want independence, even if it's delayed by a few years. And I think that mistrust is going to be very hard to address, as the division within Catalan society. There are a large number of Catalans who do not support independence, so being able to reconcile those dividing views is going to be very challenging.
I'm afraid for now that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Carles Castelló Cacho. He's chief of staff of the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, and Garrett Martin, professor in the School of International Service at American University. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Encounter was produced here in Washington. Our engineer was Keith Holmes. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.